Hello and welcome to Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. I'm Paul Barclay. It's been 5 years since the global financial crisis first struck, and during that time we've seen nervous and volatile financial markets, businesses large and small shut down, some economies on the verge of collapse, and rising unemployment continuing to cause major social unrest. So it should come as no surprise that there's a growing movement dissatisfied with mainstream approaches to business and a pursuit of profit at any cost. As we try and work our way towards a lasting recovery and a post-GFC world, should we continue with business as usual, or is there an alternative approach? Tonight on Big Ideas, we discuss whether the cooperative or social enterprise model has something to offer. Co-ops are in fact an old idea, but one that appears to have been enthusiastically rediscovered and adapted to contemporary times. Did you know 2012 has been designated the United Nations Year of the Cooperative? It's probably the first time an international year has been devoted to a business model. So how do co-ops and social enterprises operate, and what's the philosophy behind them? To find out, let's go now to the BMW Edge Theatre, Federation Square in Melbourne, for highlights of the Next Gen Capitalism, Profit, People and Planet Forum, presented by the Social Enterprise Group at RMIT, Bank MECU and Social Traders. To introduce tonight's panel, I'll hand over to Michael Short, editor of The Zone on Fairfax and The Age newspaper.
The night works best if it's done with spontaneity and some robust questioning. Don't hold back. You've got an extraordinary panel. Melina Morrison is the UN Secretariat Director here and a founding director of Social Business Australia. There are 20,000 or so social businesses in Australia. Danny Elmagar is the chief executive of Small Giants, which creates and nurtures businesses shifting to social equity and environmental sustainability. Mark McKenzie McHarg has an incredible story to tell about the Yakandanda Community Development Company and what a beautifully named place is Yakandanda. He's also looking after the Mount Buffalo Community Enterprise, so he's an expert on rural and regional community buyouts. Jonathan Tessini has 30 years' experience as a prominent economic and political strategist in the US. He's now living in Sydney. So you've really got an extraordinarily broad and deep panel. So really get as much as you can out of it. I suspect that a lot of what's going on here is to do with enlightened self-interest, and I mean that at a number of levels. In the work that I've been doing in The Zone, I find an extraordinary spirit coming through a lot of community organisations at a time when there's some perhaps justifiable lament, particularly, for example, on the issue of asylum seekers, about a lack of political leadership in Australia. But what I'm finding is an extraordinary amount of community innovation and community leadership. There are 600,000 not-for-profit organisations in Australia. They employ one in 12 of us. They create 5% of our GDP. Now, social enterprises include not-for-profits, but we're not here, I don't think, although it'll be interesting to see what happens with the questions and the answers, but I don't think we're here to attack capitalism per se. Social enterprises are about applying business ideas and business expertise to not only making a profit, but solving some social and environmental issues. The greatest form of social justice, I think, is having a job. And these are enterprises that are giving a lot of people a lot of opportunity and employment. So we're talking about the long term, we're talking about well-being, and it's interesting at the moment in Australia that there's a movement, and it's bringing us up to speed with the rest, well, a lot of other countries in the world, to try and measure well-being in the community through other than GDP. GDP, gross domestic product, measures what we produce in the economy, but it leaves out a lot of things that matter a lot to people. And there's a thing called ANDI being developed in Australia at the moment, the Australian National Development Index. And I think that that relates to what we're talking about tonight. So I'm going to turn it over to the panel now and then over to you. Start preparing your questions. Put your hand up for the microphone. I'll try and see you. Wave or stand up. Tweet your questions. Get as much out of it as you can. have some enlightened self-interest this evening. I wish everybody a really great night. And we're going to start with the panel spending a couple of minutes each just talking a little bit about what they do, what they think, what they feel, what they care about. And we're going to start with Melina Morrison. Thanks very much.
Thank you for bringing up self-interest, enlightened self-interest, because one of the things that so attracted me to cooperatives as a business model when I first became aware of them about a decade ago when I was writing stories on co-ops from around the world for the International Cooperative Alliance was this neat trick that they have of bringing self-interest into a group self-interest environment, rolling together the customer, the owner, the shareholder, the member into the one person so that you don't have the tension between different stakeholders in a profit-driven company. That means that you're actually requiring stakeholders to compete with each other at the same feeding trough for benefits of their capital that's derived from that business. So I very much see co-ops as consortiums of entrepreneurs, if you like. They truly are a community-based model of business. Most importantly, I think, who I am is that I'm a cooperator. And I say that unashamedly because I really do believe that cooperatives and other forms of social business are the best way to democratise capital, to socialise capital, to move economic power from the few to the many. And I believe that co-ops are a very profound business model at scale operating in the globe. 1 billion cooperators, three times as many as there are investor shareholders around the globe. 1.5 million cooperative businesses, 100 million employees, 20% more than multinational companies. So we're talking about a very, very large business sector here. And I truly believe that co-ops are the best way to combine market force and social impact or social objective. And I'm really quite moved, I must say, by the number of people who've come out tonight to talk about a next generation of capitalism. I suppose that's my other sort of defining thought in relation to co-ops, and that is that we come to a place in our evolution, our economic evolution, where the model that's been tested for a while, that short-term profit-maximising model, has profoundly failed. It's failed economically, socially, environmentally. And even in Australia, it's often said that we got away. We were inured of the shocks of the GFC. We got off quite lightly, and we are an affluent nation. There's no doubt about it. But I don't know if you feel the same way, but I certainly feel that something is broken. I feel like even in this affluence, we still have a sense of a widening disparity between rich and poor, of inequality, of market concentration that's causing a homogenised high street, if you like, and perhaps a profound sense that we need self-help models to get on with the job of addressing some of the big global issues that are coming to us, particularly through climate change and other macro issues like that. So I guess that's me.
Thanks, Melina. Mark?
Thanks, Michael. I moved to Yackandandah in the year 2000, and people have called me a tree changer. I suppose if the cap fits, I need to wear it. Soon after arriving there, I found that in small rural communities, there's really nowhere to hide if stuff happens. And I found myself involved in the formation of the Yackandandah Community Development Company, as Michael referred to, which is basically a little country petrol station that runs the local hardware shop and the local community newspaper and a few things like that. My role there was as a foundation shareholder and founding chairman. Michael asked that we sort of, in this introduction, to talk about what we care about, and I might expand that a little bit about what I care about, what I worry about, and what I'd like to see. I care passionately about the future of rural and regional Australia, and I think it's part of our very national identity, so I care strongly about that. I also care about what is referred to as a social enterprise sector. That's a term I hadn't heard when I first got involved in this field. We called it community enterprise, just doing stuff because it needed to be done. But I care about a robust social enterprise sector, and in my mind, that's one that is not going to become reliant on public capital as its engine room. I think a future robust social enterprise sector needs to have mechanisms and frameworks and structures, both within the law, importantly within the law and within the Corporations Act, which enable it to embrace private capital as the means of getting stuff done. And that means it needs to embrace the notion of profit rather than shun it. So I look forward to an interesting discussion, and I'll hand over to Danny.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. I guess I'll tell you the brief story about how I got here. My journey was, I guess our journey started a very long time ago, but I'll start just after university. I started something called Engineers Without Borders, which is a non-profit, like the Without Borders brand that you might have heard of, sends engineers around the world to do aid work. So it's very much in the non-profit world. And at the same time, I wasn't making any money, so I had to start a company to try and help fund myself. My parents helped out a bit and other stuff, but in the end, I started a company called Medivax, which was a corporate health provider. And I ran both of those for quite a number of years and built them up separately, which was kind of weird because, you know, my office, which was out of my old bedroom, had two phones in it. So one of them would ring and you'd answer, and I'd kind of be a bit nervous that I'd answer the wrong phone with the wrong message, which happened a few times. But it was kind of good. Sometimes I got a contract when someone was ringing for Engineers at Borders to vaccinate their staff. So that was cool. But I guess through that journey, I really felt that there were sort of two sides, and you know, I guess this is something that maybe a lot of people in the social enterprise space, or however you define yourselves, feel, which is one hat you wear is commercial, and you know, this is a business and it's about making profit, and very much for me, although you know, healthcare I think is an amazing benefit to society, the business that I was running wasn't intentional in that way. Obviously I wanted to do something that was good, but it wasn't about, you know, we didn't have a mission to try and, you know, create the healthiest Australia possible. It was a way to make some money so that I could continue to follow my passion, which was Engineers Without Borders. And I guess finally it sort of came to me that I was wearing one hat which was commercial and profit-driven, one hat which was mission-driven and obviously non-profit, and felt that there was a sense of imbalance. And along with my wife, who, you know, has an amazing story of her own, we sort of said, we need to find something that's in between. Can you mix this idea of profit and purpose? I also much prefer running a for-profit than a non-profit. For those who've been involved in a non-profit, I think it's much, much harder than a for-profit because you've got all these extra bits that you have to consider, whereas a for-profit, ultimately you've got a product or a service and, you know, somebody's interested in it or they're not. The feedback is direct. So I find that a little bit easier. So it was kind of this nice space in between. And we read a book called Small Giants, which I absolutely loved. I didn't know about the term social enterprise, and still sort of, although I've embraced it and I actually sit part-time at RMIT as a social entrepreneur in residence, I never sort of think of it as social enterprise. It's too hard to sort of define. For me, it's about just a different, I guess, the concept of today, the paradigm around doing business. And Small Giants was a book that spoke a lot about that paradigm. Businesses that choose to be great instead of big. And that was a bit of that moment when my wife and I sort of looked at each other and said, wow, that's, you know, we've got to go down that path, and slowly exited out of Medivax, ended up selling that, and exited out of Engineers at Borders and got involved in Small Giants. And what Small Giants was really a facilitation vehicle for businesses we thought were bringing those two things together, bringing profit and purpose, and sort of, I guess, in the simplest way, making the difference in the world that we wanted to see. And that's very much what Small Giants does now. We invest in or partner with, nurture businesses that, you know, that I guess, you know, we share a passion with the idea and have a wonderful relationship with the management, or indeed sometimes we see a gap and we start our own. So it's kind of a very eclectic, diverse group of businesses, from organic female products, tampons and pads, Tom, to magazines, and we've had investments in hospitality, in restaurants, and even in sustainable property development. So it's incredibly diverse. And what brings us together, I guess, as a business is, instead of being vertically integrated, sort of saying, you know, we do, we focus on products, you know, within one category, we kind of said, we want to focus on the person. You know, that person is me and the staff at Small Giants. What are we passionate about? What do we want to fill our lives with? And then we try and find companies that we love, that we want to have, you know, within our lives. Where do we buy our products or our clothes and this and that? And occasionally we find someone who needs a bit of help, who fits that bill, and we try and get involved and help them out. So that gives you a bit of a sense of Small Giants and my background. I guess the point for me of being here tonight is, or part of the conversation, is I think it really is, as I said, sort of the Small Giants idea was that paradigm shift between those two different hats that people wear. I think we need to shift society. I've got this sense, and I'm an engineer, so apologise for people who don't get graphs, but I'm going to do a graph, right? So imagine you've got a horizontal and a vertical axis, right? And on one side you've got profit, and on the other side you've got people and the planet. So imagine that as a dichotomy. I don't think it needs to be a dichotomy. I think, you know, the idea of a triple bottom line or you know, holistic business is the way we should be thinking about it. But I think in our world today, largely in the business sector, we do have that dichotomy of it's either about profit or it's about people in the environment, and obviously that sits at the non-profit end. And I just think we've been skewed. You know, the whole point of us being on this planet is to find balance. You know, and that balance changes and moves around, and this is getting very zen, but there's a balance, and I sort of feel we're just incredibly out of balance at the moment. And one of the things Small Giants would like to do is sort of grab that curve. So imagine, obviously, on that axis, we've got too many people on that side, at least when they're in their waking hours, you know, before they get home and hang out with their kids or their partners. And our job is quite simple, and I think we're all here because we sort of feel like we need to grab that mass and just shift it across a bit. And we're hoping that Small Giants is an example of how that can be done, that's still commercial. It's a way to be able to live your life within the value system.
Jonathan.
Well, good evening, everyone. So I think since I'm not from Australia, maybe I'll make several points that I think touch on what's happening here and also in other parts of the globe, particularly the U.S., which is where most of my experience has been. The first thing is that in the past year, we've seen the whole Occupy Wall Street movement erupt, certainly in the United States and spread all around the world. And a lot of that happened in New York. I took part in a lot of the demonstrations there and listened to folks. And really, there was one simple message, is that something is not working. We're pissed off. Something has to be fixed. And this economy, this world is not working for us, meaning the 99%, as Melina's button states, that famous slogan. And in Michael's introduction, he said, we're not here to attack capitalism. And I think that's right, because the problem is not capitalism. The problem is corrupt, so-called free market, cronyism capitalism, which is very, very different. Because that system, corrupt, free market, so-called free market, which I would argue actually doesn't exist, it's just a marketing phrase, cronyism has led us to the greatest robbery in human history, the greatest transfer of wealth from the people to a few. In the U.S., for example, the United States now, the richest nation that has ever been on this planet in human history, has the highest level of poverty since they started taking statistics on that. In the richest nation in human history. That is corrupt free market capitalism at its purest form. And so what we're here today to talk about is, how do we create an economic system with rules that benefit the majority of people? Now, there are probably people here in the audience from the business community who work in this. If you took your hats off for a second and thought for a moment is this system working in the world? I'm just, you know, as a human being, not as the CEO of a company or a manager, do you think this system is working in the world in terms of guaranteeing prosperity? And the honest answer has to be no. The second point is, and this I feel, when people ask me who I am, the thing I really mostly say is I'm a member of a union, and I'm proud of that. The labor movement, meaning small L unions, is the greatest force for economic justice and economic prosperity in human history. And in the U.S., when we have talked often about social capitalism doing socially viable companies, too often we forget in that equation having unions and strengthening unions. There will never be economic prosperity for the whole unless the labor movement is strong again. Now, if you want to debate about issues, problems, and differences in the labor movement, how we can do things better, I'm open to that discussion. But in terms of bringing prosperity to the majority of people, unions are an essential part of that. And you can actually go back to your graph. If you look at the United States, and I'm going to be generally using my hand movements like this as a New Yorker, you can look at a line going straight up where productivity has increased over the last 30 years, which means people have been working their asses off really hard. And at that exact line is the mirror opposite to the decline in unions. So what has happened is that people have been working really hard and productivity has been skyrocketing somewhat because of technology, but mostly because they've been working hard. And at the exact same time, unions have been declining. So what has happened is all that productivity, all that wealth that has been created has not gone to the 99%. The last point I'll make is this, and I don't have an answer for this observation. There is a tension, and Melina referred to it a little bit, about the collapse of the planet. And I find one of the most troubling things that I find in the United States, and I think it's true in other countries, is that union leaders, political leaders on both sides of the parties are always arguing about growth, growth, growth. We can grow, we can grow, we can grow, we can expand, we can expand. And it's not clear to me that's a survivable route. That the planet is this close to collapse, and in many ways has already started collapsing, we can't simply continue to grow in the way that we used to think about growth without leaving to future generations a completely destroyed planet. A guy named Herman Daly, who used to work for the World Bank, an economist, observed that really the challenge to us is to think about how we grow the economy qualitatively to make it a better economy for people, that we share resources in a better way, that we're more efficient rather than quantitatively. And I think that's important to remember as we talk about social capitalism. How do we do that in the context of a planet that's under stress? Thank you.
Jonathan Tessini, union leader and organizer. His area of interest is work, labor, and the economy. On RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national, you're with Big Ideas. Tonight we're in Melbourne for Next Gen Capitalism, Profit, People and Planet. Before we head back for the question and answer session, let me quickly reintroduce the other panel members. Melina Morrison is a director of Australia's Secretariat for the UN Year of Cooperatives. Danny Almagor is the founder and CEO of Small Giants. He's also social entrepreneur in residence at RMIT. And Mark McKenzie McCarg is founder of the Yakandanda Community Development Company. Back now to Federation Square in Melbourne and our moderator, Michael Short.
While you're getting the microphone there, we've got one here on the Twitter feed from, I hope I get this pronunciation correct, Phil. This is Phil Schlem. It's a question for Danny. Small Giants are the first Aussie B Corp. Could you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, sure. Just interesting for me to see. Can you put your hand up if you've heard of a B Corporation or know what a B Corporation is? So that's cool. There are a few people. So if I don't explain it well, look for the people with their hand up and they'll tell you better. But that's pretty great that a lot of people know it. B Corporation is an idea that came out of the US, a non-profit called B Labs, who were doing a rating system on businesses for impact investors. So if you're an investor and you wanted to invest in a business, you know, and you had the values that we're talking about, you know, you're trying to work out how to make sure that this business is a good business to invest in. And they came up with a rating scheme called the Global Impact Investment Rating Scheme, GIRS. Out of that came this idea that maybe if, you know, if we're an investment firm and we're looking to invest in a business and we're using this rating scheme, wouldn't it be great if businesses could actually rate themselves and get accredited? So ultimately what happened is B Corporation was created as, I guess, a label, a standard, a bit like organic or fair trade. So if you go to the supermarket and buy a fair trade block of chocolate, well, you know that behind that label fair trade, there's a whole lot of rigor, due diligence, you know, auditing of the process to get that chocolate to you, the farmers, etc. So B Corporation is basically a process that a business can go through, a whole lot of questions, about 200 questions from transparency to governance to diversity in your workplace, environmental sustainability, you know, workers' rights, etc., even to the extent of, you know, profit share or ownership issues. So you fill in all these questions, and ultimately if you get above a certain target or a certain number, you're eligible to be a B Corp. And that number, I think it's a wonderful process, and we obviously adopted and became Australia's first B Corp about maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. I think their process makes it incredibly hard to bullshit the system, basically. You know, it's very difficult to greenwash and get your way through enough answers to be able to get that accreditation. So what it's really doing, it's really separating those who truly believe to those who want to just give a perception that they're doing better stuff. And with so many people who know about it, really the only benefit of B Corporation is if it becomes a movement. And for me, the concept of joining B Corp is we've just joined another 500 other companies. So it's not workers, but companies that have chosen to come together and say, we don't like the system, we want to change that system as well. So it's, again, it's a union of companies, I don't know. But in a sense, that's really what B Corporation's trying to do.
How would you advise, I mean, we may be preaching to the converted here, I'm not sure, but those who want to get involved in the sort of thing you're talking about, to set up a cooperative or to launch a business, and I think part of the answer to this is probably technology. The web has created, you know, has brought down a lot of barriers, for example, in media where there's a lot of disruption going on. But how would you advise people to get cracking?
I want to see us all become disruptive capitalists now, agitators in the market. You can occupy the market, and you can do it right now through your consumer choices. Become aware that there are different forms of business and that you have a discretionary dollar. You can spend your dollar and invest it in a business that is investing directly in the community. Not all the time. I mean, we live in a biodiverse environment where we're spreading our consumer dollar around, but co-ops, mutuals, employee-owned enterprises, not-for-profits that are companies limited by guarantee, the trading arms of charities, other forms of social enterprise, B Corps, community-owned businesses. These are businesses that are structurally different. They distribute the wealth. They do two things. They share prosperity and they believe in social value as a core of the DNA of the business, not an add-on, but as actually the reason for conducting business. So we can all engage in that disruption in the marketplace by choosing to consume or to trade with co-ops, customer-owned banks, credit unions, other forms of social enterprise, and we can choose them as the preferred model of business when we are trying to address a need, a market need. All of these businesses trade in the market for a social outcome. They all wash their face in commercial waters. Profit is really important. It's what happens with the profit. And that's the difference, I think, the defining. I think we should also keep a certain level of cynicism, healthy cynicism, as we see the modern corporation come on board the bandwagon, which is to pay more attention to a triple line. Is it really deeply embedded in the business? Have they really overcome the tension between the need to extract the capital for the disinterested shareholders or to truly give back to the community?
There's a question down here.
One of my favourite authors is Theodore Zeldin, and he made the observation that in most meetings, pride or caution prevents people from saying what they truly believe. I say this because people in organisations are afraid to speak up and they're afraid to take action when they see poor decisions being made, when they see decisions made on the basis of either profit or corruption. And I wonder if anyone on the panel has an idea about how we can overcome the bystander mentality that is really rife throughout society. In organisations, in social spheres, in political spheres, it seems that everyone's waiting for everyone else to take action that's socially constructive. And sometimes, of course, people are very frightened to do so because they'll find themselves cut off at the knees. But has anyone got any ideas about how we might tackle the idea of the bystander phenomenon?
Jonathan.
I hate to sound like a one-note pony here, but that's one of the reasons that unions existed, is to give people that collective voice, because it is very, very hard for people to stand up, certainly in the context of a company. And out in society, it's very hard because, particularly if you're looking for political leaders, and the political leaders seem to be saying the same things, and don't seem to be, for example, you've got the empty suit, which is the name I use for the leader of the coalition, who seems to be just repeating this American disease idea that they want to be in government to follow the exact same policies that have failed for 30 years. And so if you're the average individual person who wants to engage in society and you see that kind of dialogue, your attitude, and I don't blame it, and this happens in the US, so they say, forget it, I'll just go on with my life. So it's partly fear, but it's also, I think, a little bit of people are exhausted. You know, if you again, this is mostly in the U.S., my experience, if you've got two jobs and you drop your kids off, you know, in daycare and you run to one job and you come to the next job, most Americans, first of all, don't then vote on election day because they're too tired, but they also don't want to engage, and so they kind of retreat. That said, and this would be I'm generally an optimist, so looking at it optimistically, I know it doesn't sound like it, right? Look what happened with Occupy Wall Street. I mean, people did a lot of criticizing of that, but when you walked and actually marched in those rallies, there were a lot of people there who had not been walking and marching in 30 years. I remember walking actually in one march, and there was this pretty well-dressed couple pushing a stroller, and I heard him say to her, oh, boy, I haven't done this since like 1970-something. And so there's both of those. There's the exhaustion, and there's the connection of these movements. I have, in the later years of my life, given up on electoral politics, even having actually run for office once. I think it's all about movements. And the only way we actually have change in this society is if we build broad-based movements on people to basically set rules that don't allow what you suggested. The question is not, can I point out the good companies and what they're doing? It's not because they're bad people. It's because we have to set the new rules. We are the ones that have to stand up and basically shake the country, shake the planet, and take control. And that's the only way we'll engage again.
Milena, do you want to come in on that?
Oh, I'd just like to give an example right here in Victoria of the way. I totally agree with what you're saying, Jonathan. I think on the flip side of the apathy that you're perhaps pointing to, there's an incredible rise in movements like collaborative consumption, people self-organising around a need, an identified need. It can be formalised into something like a cooperative, or it can be informal, but it's still a community of need addressing a communal issue. And there's a rise in these. Social media's picked up on it fantastically. So the energy and the innovation is there. I feel really positive when I hear about business ventures like Hepburn Wind. Have we got someone here tonight from Hepburn? What an amazing example of community response that is. I know Danny's very familiar with them. Dalesford, community of people sick of waiting around for the political cycle of discussion about carbon pricing, climate change, whether we're going to do anything, set up a business, a commercially high-end business in green energy production. That wind farm now supplies the town, produces a surplus that's fed back to the grid. It's highly profitable. It is supplying their community need to have access to a green energy source. It wasn't a company coming in and doing it for them. It wasn't an outside investor saying, we'll set up a wind farm here, we'll generate profit for shareholders, and we'll supply the town with green energy. This is a community-owned company. And these are the kind of examples of self-help that can be utilised by communities. You asked before, what can we do? We actually have these legal models available. We can take them and we can decide that we can actually respond to our social needs as groups of people. We have to do it, in fact.
There's a question down here and there's one over here, but before we go there, Mark, your experience in Yakandanda is just an extraordinary story. Mm. Can you talk just very quickly about what happened, and perhaps point people who might be interested in that to somewhere online they could find the story? Is there somewhere? Because it's a beautiful story.
I wanted to raise a family in a country town, and a country town somewhere that's not a sort of an outer suburban place. It had to meet certain criteria, and it had to have a pub. It had to have a public hall. It had to have some shops. So it had to be a town in the traditional sense of the word. And soon after we moved there, the only petrol station was going to shut. And everyone was running around, passing hats around the main street, saying, throw $5 in the hat, we'll see what we can do. And it became very clear quickly that, you know, $5 in the hat was not going to resolve this. What we really needed was to get $1,000 from every family in the town if we really wanted to. We could see this as just sort of the thin end of the wedge in terms of what was happening in rural townships. So we formed, and it was more about than petrol. So we formed a community development company, the constitution of which does not mention the word fuel, energy or petrol. We set it up as an unlisted public company. We issued an offer information statement, which is subsidiary to a prospectus. And we basically said to people in the town, if you believe in the future of your township, buy shares in it. And they did. They did at a rate. Yakandanda's got a population of about 800 or 900 people. The subscription rate of that share offer, if you transposed it to metropolitan Melbourne at the time, I did a quick calculation, if you did the same thing in Melbourne, you would have raised enough money to build CityLink out of metropolitan Melbourne. So that's the sort of relativity it was. It's trading today. This is not a gold mine business. Selling fuel is a mug's game by any measure. But it's pretty important to the township, and that's what it's all about. It employs young kids. It ekes out a meagre living. It makes a small surplus, and it's an important company. So that's the story.
And it made sense too, didn't it? Because there was again enlightened self-interest, because you were going to have to drive 40 kilometres to get petrol. So it would have increased the real cost of what you were doing. We've got a question down here.
I was just wanting to help Jonathan out a little bit. Jonathan, you mentioned before that the ACTU may have endorsed cooperatives. They've actually endorsed a project called the Earthworker Cooperative. And to cut a long story short, the idea is to produce solar hot water units in Morwell, where there is a lot of energy-intensive industry, move workers across to sustainable jobs that they own as a cooperative, producing solar hot water units, and union members in industries where there's high membership actually bargaining for those solar hot water units as part of their package, so their power bills go down because we've just got this carbon tax that's come in. So the ACTU's taken a pretty big risk, and it's pretty edgy stuff for the union movement to be involved in this kind of thing, because There's lots of people in that movement that might say, oh, look, let's just stick to getting the best deal possible in this company. This idea is actually people forming the company themselves, getting involved in social entrepreneurship and building up something that could be as big as Mondragon, which, as we know, as some people might know here, is one of the largest cooperatives in the world in Basque Spain, a huge powerhouse, which the employees actually own this huge company. There's a huge credit union as well, and there's a cooperative university. So the vision is Mondragon and Morwell, believe it or not, to have a kind of an ecosystem of mutual business, working with each other, funding a new enterprise in the cooperative space.
You know, there's a restaurant called Colors in New York. If you ever go take a trip to New York, go to a restaurant called Colors, which is owned by the workers who survived the September 11th collapse of the World Trade Towers. They worked in the Windows on the World. Some of you may have eaten there some one year. When the towers collapsed, they happened not to be at work. And so they came together as workers to own that restaurant and run it themselves. So it's sort and I was a very regular customer there. So I applaud that, what you're doing there in that.
Just very quickly, I'm so glad you've brought up about Earthworker, because that's such a fantastic example in the International Year of Co-ops of how the synergy between cooperatives and workers can work so well. That wonderful nascent enterprise will transition those coal workers into green energy jobs. But most importantly, it's the jobs that they own. And when they are the stakeholders, the major stakeholders in that enterprise, then the core value of the company is the value of work, not capital. Capital is the means or the tool, not the end in itself. It's the value of work. And you mentioned Mondragon. Mondragon is Spain's seventh largest corporation. It's a business, a federation of worker-owned cooperatives. 83,000 workers own those companies. Another 20,000 or so employed. Spain has 52% youth unemployment. But if you live in the Basque region, in the Mondragon economy, a fantastic ecosystem, you will experience half that rate of unemployment. When the GFC hit, those workers had to come together very quickly. Remember, they are the major stakeholder in the business, enlightened self-interest. They decided to take a wage cut of 7.5% based on the knowledge that this was about long-term sustainability, that they had to keep their jobs viable. These were the businesses they owned. They were making a decision about the viability of the business. And this is where the fantastic connection between co-ops and the labour movement can go so far. And there's a great tradition of connection between trade unions and co-ops. Trade union movements were foundation partners in the great credit union sector of Australia. We're the third largest credit union sector in the world after Canada and the US, and that came out of a great connection between trade unions wanting to socialise the workers' capital, as it did, Michael mentioned, with the industry superannuation sector.
We've got another question here. Thank you.
Danny, I think, like yourself, I've had a professional journey where I've been trying to bridge the profits, people, and planet. And in my daylight job, I was doing finance in the U.S., working in private equity, and then at night, working in the nonprofit sector on a volunteer basis and trying to bridge those together. I'm still searching for that elusive entry point where I can bridge those to value sets, where I can meet my daily needs as well as fulfill and meet my value aspirations. And I'm sure there are a number of people in this audience that also are looking for that. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas or have thought about how people on a personal level can really pursue those values in a professional context.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that there's an element of build it and they will come, and that's definitely been our experience with small giants. I agree, and for me, the manifestation of that was small giants, and really the intention was to create a whole lot more. It's kind of like a beacon for yourself to come and join, whether it's in small giants or one of the businesses, or one of the family of businesses that surround it, even if it's not, you know, an investment of ours. And I guess that's the movement we're trying to create. I find that there aren't that many. There are plenty around, but plenty around that we don't know about, you know, that have existed for a very long time. The idea of, you know, a social enterprise or, you know, profit with purpose or whatever you want to call it, is not new. And you know, there are some like Oxfam that have been running a shop, you know, commercial shop for a very long time that does amazing things. My sense of the reason why the movement or the term social enterprise is actually quite relevant and important today is it's just a calling card. It's just a label for now. You know, I'd like to think that we get rid of that label. You know, eventually it's like, you know, there's business and then there are, you know, the arseholes. And we don't think of business as a bad thing. We think of business as adding value to the world. And then there are just some who don't get it and we leave them behind. But until that, you know, I think that, you know, that element is still a minority. I'd get involved in whatever club or group or society or Will Chat or whatever it is. We just need to build it. You know, we need to build this network. And that can come through building your own company or working for another one that's just started or involved. Or I think there's also really significant value in shifting some of the big organisations. I think, as I said, I think they're ripe. A lot of the people are ready for this, but it's, I guess, that first question that we had earlier on, which is the bystander issue, and I think there's an element of human nature there. You know, there's human behaviour stuff that people leave it. Just don't be one of those people.
Okay, we've got the next question up the back there. Thank you.
I was a little bit frustrated because we're talking about laws as ways of... Well, the corporate law and how people respond to that, but I missed the whole bit of what about incentivizing social enterprise, not, you know, through tax breaks, through, you know, name it what it could be. It could be a law reform or tax reform. I personally have been doing research into how to fund or set up a social business, and in doing that, I'm intrigued by this whole conversation about being in the system or out of the system. And so when you're in the system, you can go to a venture capitalist and you have a great technology idea and you can get money. If you're out of the system, you're a not-for-profit potentially and you can get money. If you want to change the system, in the system, there's nowhere to go or there are very few places to go. I just wonder what you think of that.
Well, you can go somewhere, and that is to your community. Communities can invest in businesses. They can raise the equity. They do it all the time to fund businesses that have social purpose. I do agree that there's not enough information out there. I mean, it's how many people here have done commerce or legal degrees? Were co-ops, cooperatives, mutuals, other forms of trading entity discussed during your degrees? Maybe a little bit. It's quite possible to go through a commerce, a legal degree, and not address one of the major forms of incorporation that's actually taking place in our society. We do need intermediaries, professionals who are knowledgeable and encouraging to incentivise communities to know how to put the financial package together that you need to start something up. And certainly there's not enough public awareness of the range of models and opportunities that there are to engage in socially focused enterprise.
Before we come to you, there was another question further back. Thank you.
Anyways, I had Canada's 8th B Corporation, so I'm quite glad to see a new one in Australia having started up. I have a question, having been in the social enterprise game for a little while and having gone through a shareholder proxy battle and lost it, how do you guard against mission drift once you have a successful enterprise and let's say you're in a situation where the shareholders might say, well, now that this is a successful business, we want to take it into this sphere as opposed to what its original sphere was. So talk about governance and how you deal with potential mission drift.
Great question, and I think, Mark, you also mentioned it. One is to institutionalise it. I guess like B Corp, they have a declaration of interdependence, which is kind of cute. You can check it out. But there are, once it's legislated, so in America there are a number of states that actually legislate some benefits if you are a B Corp, there's actually rigour around redefining, you know, your constitution. So I think that's one way. So if you ever do sell it or whatever it is, people have to inherit, you know, I guess these clauses, a bit like what you can do with the land, you know. You can put certain caveats on it. So I think that's one way of doing it. I guess the other way is, I hate public companies. I hate the idea of anonymous shareholders. I think that that's one of the cancers in our society, this idea that, you know, I'm limited in my liabilities. I can own a share today and decide to sell it or buy it this morning and sell it this afternoon. And there's a wonderful book called Fixing the Game, which talks about the challenge between the expectations market, which is the share market, and then the real market, which is what we actually engage in. And it's almost like having the players on a football team betting on the game. And it's outrageous. I mean, we don't allow it. And I can't remember the guy's name, but who put a $20 bet and was fined and you know, had to miss games and all that. But we have a system here where anyone can bet and the same people are running the system. You know, there's an incentive there, obviously, to game the system. You know, if we set a standard and then, you know, beat it, you know, we say we won't do very well this year and then do a little bit better than we thought, share price can go up and I can play that game. So my argument would be stay out of the share market. Don't IPO. In fact, I had a company that came to us and said, you know, invest in us. It's amazing. And they had a great, great team and they had a great vision for what they wanted to achieve in the world and great impact. But their exit was an IPO. And I just said, well, like, you know, how can we, exactly your question, I said, how can we guard this impact in the future? So we decided not to invest.
What does the panel think that can be done to redress the incredible imbalance we have now with a lot of youth who cannot get a job because older people can't retire because they're of the lack of growth in superannuation? You've got about 60% people with disabilities who are unemployed, Indigenous people, people from other cultures, and you know, people who are made redundant because of other factors. What can the social enterprise system have a role to play in redressing inequity in these areas?
Mark, you want to take that?
Yeah, thanks. It's a good question that you refer to, you know, a very wide range of problems that we face as a society. But can I say this to you? Let's not overburden the notion of social enterprise with all of society's woes. Let's be realistic about what it is and what it can do and not make the mistake of saying that social enterprise is going to be some form of or some panacea for all of the social problems we know exist with poverty. It is just one piece of the mosaic that is society, and we'd like to see it grow in its importance. A lot of the things this gentleman referred to in his questions, critical as they are, they're things that need responses through what I call social programs, social interventions. You know, the pure private sector has a role in that. But I don't think we should make the mistake of trying to burden the social enterprise sector as being the answer to all of our challenges in society.
From Yakandanda, that was Mark McKenzie McCarg. Joining him on the panel discussing social enterprise were Melina Morrison, Danny Almagor and Jonathan Tessini. Next Gen Capitalism, Profit, People and Planet was presented by RMIT's Social Enterprise Group, Social Traders and Bank MECU. Thanks to our moderator, Michael Short from Fairfax Media's The Zone.